I'd like to thank everybody for coming out. We're actually recording this panel today for a podcast on Carl Scheinemann's ESI Bytes. It's a podcast available on iTunes, and it is a great resource for everything e-discovery. I was in Professor Wasserman's e-discovery seminar class last semester, and he has everything on there. Any like really minute details, you'll find it on there, and a lot of really great panelists that he talks to. So let me introduce everybody first. Down here at the end, we have Federal Judge Norberry Fisher. Judge Fisher sat as the chair of the court of, subcommittee. She sat as the chair of the court subcommittee, which planned to develop the court's e-discovery special master's program here in the Western District of Pennsylvania. This program has been touted as the first of its kind nationally and will assist the court's management of ESI issues in complex cases, including patent litigation. Joe DiMeno is a shareholder at Dickey McCamey. He concentrates his practice in the areas of commercial litigation, banking litigation, employment law, healthcare law, with a particular emphasis in technology and electronic discovery matters. Tom Grix here at the end is a partner at Schneider Harrison. He's the litigation services department. Partner at Schneider Harrison. He's the litigation services department chair of the firm's e-discovery practice group. He is primarily a trial attorney specializing in complex commercial litigation matters with a particular emphasis on environmental and construction industry law. Ann Peterson, in the middle, is a recent addition to the e-discovery practice group at Reed Smith. She's formerly the director of discovery compliance and information management at Precise, which is a electronic
service provider.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ann also serves as the director of e-discovery education and services at Duquesne University. Ann is a clinical adjunct professor at Duquesne Law, where she teaches the first e-discovery course in the country to use live search and review software in a law school environment. Ann began her career as an IBM systems engineer. Very impressive. And Carl, here at the left, created ReviewLess, which combines his experiences with electronic discovery staffing and project management for electronic discovery projects. His progressive work validates the use of analytics and technology to reduce the manpower needed to review documents in electronic discovery. He's also well known nationally and internationally as the creator and moderator as the largest e-discovery podcast, ESI Bytes, which we're here with today. All right. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. So let's just start with the bare bones. What is everybody's background, and how did you get involved in electronic discovery?
My turn?
Your turn. We're starting with you.
Wait a second. It's like sitting at the end of the table. I actually have the
You're a little
bill.
Lower.
actually, it's kind of interesting. I'm an engineer, actually, by training. Went to Carnegie Mellon in chemical engineering. And I suppose that's probably where I got started, because what it ended up doing is getting me involved in programming, computers, and everything technical. I then ended up moving into law, and several years ago I was asked to help the firm by heading up its litigation support department so that I could actually try to interpret between lawyers and technicians about the issues that have to come into play in e-discovery. I did that for a couple of years, and they said, okay, so why don't you actually chair an e-discovery practice at the firm? And I said, sure, I'd be glad to do that. So I've been the chair of the firm since then.
I started off working in public accounting after law school, and I made it to a law firm in town, Marcus and Shapiro, suing accountants. Tell me about accounting, but in the far more litigation. And I was the person that was running our summation database trying to find information, not knowing how to use it, but no one else knew how to use it either. So I did single keyword searches for documents, which is a lot like building the pyramids, except by yourself. Then, you know, and so I consider that part of e-discovery because we were using technology, just not really very well. Then I own a company called Legal Network, which was a temp company, legal staffing, contract attorneys. And I noticed we were getting more projects, throwing lots of people at projects. Our first big project had 35 people and lasted a year. But when I sold the company, we had a project that lasted 5 years and had 200 people on it for almost 5 years. So you can see the amount of data growing and the amount of people really trying to keep up with looking at all this data. And that got me interested, and I've been studying it ever since.
I became interested when I worked at IBM. I installed one of the first relational databases in the United States, and after that, I went to law school, and it was very interesting to me. I had a case where you had to restore some backup tapes, and back then it was sequential. It was a very complicated, expensive, tedious job. And I've seen the ability to search and retrieve and review documents just become so much easier, so much faster, time efficient, and less expensive. But I think the law still has a long way to go because I think the big issue is volume when you're trying a case, especially complex litigation. And, you know, if you really want to resolve a case on its merits, you have to know something about e-discovery in this day and age, because if someone hits reply all a couple times a day, your case just became much more complicated. So to me, it's really trying to find a way that you can look at the matter, look at the claims and defenses, and really resolve it on its issues, settlement or try it, whichever is appropriate.
Steve, I got started because I was told. I was an associate at the time. I just came out of the health law practice where basically before electronic records, this type of e-discovery was non-existent in health law. And then I moved over to the commercial litigation group, and all of a sudden, you know, retrieve these emails, you know, find these documents, do this. And as a result, I became very familiar with all these issues and some of the folks on this panel as well. And now I chair the e-discovery practice group of my firm.
And as I was introduced, I'm a federal district court judge. I've been in that role the last 5 years. And as Steve mentioned, I chair the subgroup of our ADR and case management committee to put together what we have developed as a special master program for e-discovery. And prior to my going on the bench, I had spent 30 years in trial practice. And I've seen some of these issues play out. I'm old enough that I can recall hard copy document repositories, but one of the last cases that I had before going on the bench was a 4-complaint, 19-plaintiff toxic tort case against my then client. It was in front of our current chief, Gary Lancaster. And one of the reasons why we resolved that case when we did and how we did was because of the problem that we were dealing with a lot of old systems. We had to literally hire back people to figure out how these old systems work so that we could get the data so that we could defend this case. And the cost of all of that was incredible. Sitting on the bench, what we've seen, and Judge Conte, by the way, is the current chair of our ADR and Case Management Committee, and prior to that, Judge Schwab. What we've seen more and more is there's a dichotomy, because on the one hand, clients, businesses, but medical profession, hospitals, and the like, have gone ahead and they are using technology in many ways. And what we're seeing oftentimes is particularly lead trial counsel, usually the older attorneys in the office, are not as savvy from a technology standpoint. So our special master program tries to resolve that issue so that the people who have been selected by our court to act as special masters both have a technology background as well as a legal background so that they can mediate these disputes. And what we find in many instances is that there is a disparity, too, between one counsel and the other about what they know. And this, in our feeling, levels the playing field. Judge Conte in our court has probably had the most experience in appointing special masters. She's done it in a number of cases. Just recently, one of our senior judges, Alan Block, appointed a colleague of Ann's at Reed Smith in a criminal case. And we think that we're going to see more e-discovery issues on the criminal side, that this is not just a civil issue.
Mm-hmm. All right, good. Now I'm going to start with some questions, and we don't have to go down the line, just jump in whenever you want. But that sort of ties into my first question. What types of cases are we typically seeing the e-discovery issues coming up in, or is there any, you know, prototypical type of case, anything particular that would jump out in a case that makes it, you know, particularly difficult?
Well, e-discovery features in every case that I see, whether it's civil or criminal. And to that end, when you come to the initial case management conference in our court, you are required prior to that to meet and confer with opposing counsel. And in that vein, if you go on our website, you'll find that there's a Rule 26F report, and that report goes through a series of very detailed questions about how you're supposed to approach electronic discovery, whether there is or isn't going to be electronic discovery. And by the way, some people opt not to do any electronic discovery because of the cost. In addition, you have to figure out, you know, whether there will or won't be search terms, or whether you'll be doing some other way of approaching the data, and maybe Carl will talk about predictive coding. In addition, you'll talk about clawback agreements and Rule 502, whether that's going to apply or not, whether there's going to be a protective order because we might be dealing with trade secret or other confidential documents. So bottom line, you as counsel are supposed to prepare yourself for the meeting with me by going through this checklist and discussing this between yourselves. And in order for you to properly do that, you have to have already spoken to your client about it. So whether the case is little or big, we're going to see it. We tend to see more e-discovery issues in intellectual property cases. The patent arena particularly is full of e-discovery issues. As I mentioned, we're starting to see this on the federal criminal side. As some of you may know, our courthouse prosecutes a number of mortgage fraud cases, and as you can imagine, there's a lot of electronic documentation there. And so I see that issue in every case that comes across my desk, whether it's civil or criminal. Now remember, I'm in federal court. I don't believe that that pertains to the state system.
Yeah, I would just add, a lot of it, I think, comes from the lawyers themselves, as well as the fact that the resources in the case. But, you know, Tom, you want to lift up your iPad?
You know, and I,
you know, I've got my, all lawyers love their toys, mine's in the back, but our lives are electronic now. We're connected to people, networks. When you're trying to figure out what's happened in a dispute, you know, how people interacted with each other is core to that. These things typically don't lie because they're being recorded. So your ability as lawyers to be able to keep track of technology and embrace it and use it is, you know, I think one of the best opportunities people coming out of law school have today. Because, you know, as the judge said, many lawyers don't for one reason or another. Sometimes they think it's too expensive, and it can be. But it also doesn't have to be. And sometimes it's your best chance to get rid of a case is to find something like this. So, you know, it's really in the hands of the lawyers a lot of the time to provide the right advice. And I think the legal profession suffers from a lack of talent in that area, and that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, there's a big difference, too, between federal court and state court, at least here in Pennsylvania. Judge Fisher's in federal court, and the form that she was talking about you can find on the website is the Rule 26F report, and there's one page devoted to e-discovery matters. And I've gone to other courts in the federal system. I had a case in Chicago. They don't even have that form. And it's made it difficult as part of the meet and confer to discuss some of these issues because they're like, what are you talking about? Why are you bringing this up? I'm like, well, I anticipate it's going to be an issue in our case, so we might as well discuss it now before we go and see the judge for our initial status conference. So that form there, which is not being really adopted or used in the state courts or even some of the federal courts, but is inevitable. I mean, I think we're going to see that in every case ultimately.
And I see what we would term traditional electronic discovery used even before there's a dispute sometimes. For example, someone's going to acquire another company, they'll go and say, hey, as part of the due diligence, we want you to go collect the information, we want you to sort through the emails. What did they say internally was the value of this company? So it's being used in ways, the searching mechanisms are being used in ways that can avoid disputes, give a bit of business advantage, but it would still fall under the purview of electronic discovery, but it hasn't risen to the point where they're filing an action in federal court.
I would really echo what the judge said, because what you're going to find out is because of the reply all button, it's everywhere. Yeah. Every case is going to have email. Every communication today is probably thought about electronically in some way. It's either used electronically or it's responded to electronically. So there are emails everywhere in every case you deal with. So you're starting to see e-discovery become an issue in every case in some way. For example, one of the places where I'm starting to see it a lot, almost used as a weapon, is employment cases. You know, you have a small employment case where they're going to ask you for all of the emails that relate to all of the HR decisions made about this particular issue, and you have to find a way. Carl will talk, I'm sure, about predictive coding and ways to get through all of this electronic discovery that, as lawyers, we have to start thinking about constantly, because the price is so high that you need to find a way to do this cost-effectively and quickly, even in situations where there's mounds and mounds and masses of data. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm hearing you right, it seems like these issues are coming up when the attorneys actually are bringing them up. And correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Fisher, but will you bring up these issues if the attorneys aren't, you know, bringing them in front of you? I mean, or are you going to pick it out of them, or, you know, are you putting it on them?
When I have an initial case management conference, you know, I talk to them about the case and pay particular heed to this issue. Because as the judge who's going to preside over this case beginning to end, I want to anticipate discovery problems. And as some of you may or may not know, we federal judges are mandated to move all of our civil cases within 3 years. So it doesn't help me if a case gets stuck in the mud 2 or 3 months in because of an e-discovery issue. So if the parties have not addressed it in the type of detail that I think they should on the Rule 26F report, then I will go through that report with them and we'll spend some time. And I will ask them questions about who the records custodians are. Have they interviewed them or not? Is there a litigation hold letter in play? Are you or aren't you in agreement on search terms? Are you going to use another methodology? Some people will sample data and then they will proceed. Some people use vendors. So we talk about all of these issues. Now, as I mentioned, I've had a number of cases, particularly on the employment front, where both sides have decided that the value of the case is such that they're not going to spend time and money on e-discovery. The other thing that a practitioner is here for me is that e-discovery is a two-way street. A lot of times individual plaintiffs think this does not apply to them, that it only applies to the corporation or the business that they have sued. Wrong, because electronic discovery pertains to all kinds of electronic documents. So I routinely ask plaintiff's counsel, you know, does your client walk around with a cell phone, a BlackBerry, the like? How do they keep the diary system? It used to be people used hard copy calendars and they wrote down all of their doctor appointments and they wrote down, you know, what their medicines were and they wrote down who they talked to when. And I ask those kinds of questions. I also ask if the plaintiff's a blogger. You would be surprised how many plaintiffs are bloggers. And I ask them too, did they take pictures? Because many times people take cell phone pictures, whether it's the workplace, the accident, and the like. I'm currently the presiding judge on the G20 cases. I'm sure many of you heard about G20. And as you may know, there were a number of students who filed lawsuits because of the activities around the Cathedral of Learning. And it was through the Rule 26F conference with me that the city attorneys and the plaintiff attorneys' light bulb went off that there were cameras. Mm-hmm. Cameras on Carnegie Library, cameras on the Cathedral of Learning. And so as a consequence, ultimately the electronic discovery also included the images that were picked up by those cameras. So I think as a federal district court judge, you know, I need to probe this with counsel. But as I said, they can tell me, Judge, you don't want to do it. And if they agree, I tell them, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So don't come back in here 3 months from now after you've taken 15 depositions and said, whoops, Judge, we need to do electronic discovery.
Makes sense. All right, well, how would you all describe the practicing bar's knowledge of about electronic discovery, particularly Tom and Joe? Are you guys at the top in your firms and explaining it down to everybody else and dealing with the issues? Or is there a typical knowledge base for all the attorneys, or is it completely they're inept about it?
Yeah, we have a core of us who really know it well, and then a group in the middle that has an idea, and then the other, you know, group that's completely unaware.
Right. Just going over their head.
Yeah.
They don't care,
or they just delegate it out to others.
As I was telling Carl before we came in here, I give the entire bar, if you will, in general, an average of sub C.
Yeah.
because it's not a bell curve at all. It is very small in terms of the number of people who actually pay attention to where we are today in e-discovery, how you have to deal with these issues, what you need to know. And there's a larger set, of course, that know what they're doing, are willing to work together on it, know enough to be able to communicate and deal with the issues, but there is a much larger set that not only really doesn't know, but says they don't want to know. I mean, there are folks in my firm that say, I really don't care. I don't want to know. And frankly, what they do is if there's one that comes in that's e-discovery, they just call me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and since I don't work in a large firm, I'm freer to talk. But I think nailed it pretty well. One of the challenges, and again, the reason why opportunity, which I hope is why you know we have so many people here today, is there are so many moving parts in e-discovery. You know, at the beginning of a case, who are you collecting from? Who has ESI? Where is it? How do you get your arms around it without changing it and preserving it so it could be used in court? How do you actually search it? You know, do you search it at the beginning of the case intelligently to do an early case assessment, or you just grab everything and just throw it into an assembly line and hire a bunch of people, you know, maybe some people in this room to go yes, no, yes, yes, no, 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 you know, clicking away relevancy calls on first pass review. You know, or do you use some form of automation? Do you use sampling? I mean, it's really a lot to cover, and I don't know very many people that I consider to be experts in e-discovery as a field. I know a lot of generalists. I know a lot of people that know deeply in certain areas, and the key is to know enough of those people to be able to solve your problems, you know, intelligently. But it's a real opportunity, and I, you know, when we talk about predictive coding, I might give you a couple of examples of where I see lack of expertise.
I think it's office by office, the knowledge level goes up and down, and the attorney obligations are pretty heavy. I mean, you have to be able to speak in the 26F conferences about things like storage, how you preserve the data, you know, backup tapes, are they accessible, are they not really, reasonably accessible, and that can be a fairly technical conversation that most lawyers are not very confident having. They have to really do some in-depth research. They have to know who the custodians are. They're supposed to interview them personally or have someone interview them on their staff. At times, lawyers have been charged with taking possession of backup tapes to make sure that they're segregated and they're quarantined so information isn't spoiled and lost permanently. Those are heavy obligations, and I will speak to attorneys and I will tell them, you know, this could be within the scope of your work on this particular case, and they're amazed that they would have to speak about anything regarding backup tapes or what kind of media, CDs versus online storage versus offline storage, and they are just not comfortable with that conversation in general. I'm sure everyone here is very comfortable, but generally speaking, that is not the purview of a legal education, and they're really not prepped to do that.
Yeah, custodian interviews are critical, I think. Like Judge Fisher brought up the question about, are you a blogger? You know, there should be a checklist of questions that review. What do you post on Facebook? And also, when you go to their office, if you're representing a corporate designee or any person who works for a company, you know, they'll refer you to their computer and things like this. But if you actually go into their office and you meet with them, invariably they'll open the desk drawer. Well, would that include this thumb drive? You're like, yes, and what else, you know? Or, well, you know, I have these discs at home. Yes, it would include, you know, so sometimes having the conversation over the phone or keeping it isolated to the IT folks that might be able to provide you email files is not sufficient. And most likely, but some of the juiciest stuff is located elsewhere.
So I mean, we're talking about some pretty complex issues here, and you're having to go to outside vendors to deal with some of these. How do attorneys determine whether they have the resources to do this in-house in their own firm, or whether there's a court case that substantiates going into the e-discovery cases, like you mentioned, Judge Fisher. Sometimes, you know, the parties will just agree that it's not worth enough to even dive into them because they can become so expensive. Can you describe some of the cost associated with electronic discovery and particularly with vendors and how they decide to go outside of the law firm?
You're talking about future podcasts. I think one of the biggest complaints that people have about hiring experts and e-discovery vendors is there's always a gotcha somewhere in the pricing. No one prices the same, and you know, there are offers that sound too good to be true, and typically they are. Oh, we'll host it for, you know, no, we'll do the collection at this price, sounds great, but then once you start running into problems, you know, the prices go through the roof, and you will run into problems. And unfortunately, oftentimes that isn't clearly explained to a client, so there's an uncomfortable conversation occurring somewhere with someone that's paying the bill. So there's been a lot of push in the field to try to figure out the pricing mechanisms and make them a little bit simpler. The challenge again is the marketplace isn't, you know, educated evenly, so it lends itself to pricing, you know, in different ways to try to, you know, land a deal. And secondly, you can't get all the vendors to sit around and talk about pricing because that might be illegal, right, Judge? but anyway.
But cost can be used as a strategy too. Right. Sometimes by it can one soften up your client. If saying this is what it's going to cost on our end, and two, by serving some discovery, and then the other side has to go through the same exercise, and they see what it's going to cost them. Sometimes now people start to talk, okay, let's see if we can get a resolution, and I'm sure you've seen that in a number of cases where once the true cost of retrieval and preservation and production come to light, everybody's like, all right, let's reassess, and let's have a mediation or something.
I would make two points to this. Number one, starting about 10 years ago, corporate America started to look at these costs. And so to that end, and I'm speaking primarily of the biggest companies, they have already allied, if you will, with vendors. So oftentimes, if you're working for a big company and you're reporting to an in-house attorney, you're going to basically be told that XYZ company is the vendor that's going to be used for the electronic discovery on this particular matter, because XYZ company has probably given this company what they feel is the best rate. The other thing that is happening is more and more corporations are starting to take this process in-house. And as some of you may or may not know, we just had a federal section seminar in downtown Pittsburgh last week featuring Chief Judge Rader of the circuit. And as part of that, we had a client panel, and one of the attorneys spoke, and she's head of litigation at a pharmaceutical company, and she said she would get these bills from outside counsel, and they would say it's going to be $999999 to do the e-discovery. So then she went to a vendor, and it was still $99999 to do the e-discovery. And so she thought, we got to do this in a better way. And so now they're doing more of it in-house, not only to curtail the cost of it, but also they feel that some of the strategies that they're using in-house then help them in other areas outside of litigation related to their business. And to that end, inside legal counsel are having more and more of a say as to how, you know, a vendor will or won't be used. But to Joe's point, you know, the cost of the e-discovery, not only the vendor, but the attorney review can be very large. And I know my colleague, Judge Schwab, in a couple of cases where one party comes in and says, I need all of this, and the other party says, no, we don't really need all of this, he will make them go out into the marketplace and get estimates of what it will cost. And then they come back in and talk to him about it, and then he will probably fashion some kind of a sampling. And if that doesn't work, he basically will say to the party that wants it all, okay, you're going to get it all, but you're ultimately going to pay for it all. So there are these, if you will, pushbacks, you know, that exist in the system. And to that end, at this point in time, at least in the Third Circuit, because of the race tire decision that just was handed down by the Third Circuit, you know, as the prevailing party, you're not going to get all this money back, you know. And to that end, you know, ultimately, as Carl said, you have to have the conversation with your client. You know, what is this case overall worth? What is the realistic settlement value? What is the realistic verdict value? Here's what I'm going to charge you to take this case through motions, through trial, through appeal. This is what the vendor is going to charge you to take this case through e-discovery. And then your client, particularly in the business arena, has to make the decision, is this all worth it? It's a business decision, ultimately.
One of the things I want to add on that is I think it goes back to one of the previous questions, and that is, how much does the other attorney know and how well can I work with them to get a solution? I had a case not too long ago, there was an employment case, and they wanted all these emails, and that was at least the initial discovery request. And so I called the guy, and he actually was a pretty decent guy, kind of understood what he was talking about, and I said, look, we don't want to spend all of our money collecting this stuff and throwing it into a tool and then having it reviewed. And I said, why don't we just, you tell me what you want to find, we'll pull it off the server as a PST file, and then we'll just download it and we'll look at it and give you everything that makes sense. Okay. So at the end of the day, we saved our client a ton of money, because what's it cost these days? About $200-$300 to image a hard drive, $250 to $450 a gigabyte to process it into a tool. So it costs a lot of money to throw these things into a tool, and we were able to work that out in a way that was cost effective for the client. Recently had exactly the opposite experience, where I said to the other side, it's going to cost us both $20,000 to TIFF images. You know, we had all this, all these native files just sitting there, and I said, it's going to cost us both $20,000. Why don't we just exchange natives? You'll have a master, I'll have a master. We'll know where everything came from. We'll know what it's supposed to look like. And you can just hand it to somebody and say, here's the email. And the answer was, nah, we're just uncomfortable with natives. Let's TIFF everything. So it was $40,000 right there. Just, I would say, evaporated, but it went to a vendor somewhere to deal with that. So knowledge and cooperation is critical to being able to control the costs for your client. And that's one of the things that we try to look for when we're working with the other side.
And it is a project. A lot of lawyers don't have real great project management training or skills. And to be able to bring that case in and say, this is the workflow, we have to send it to a vendor, we have to dedupe it, we have to TIFF it, we have to make sure it's up on a load file that agrees with the other side's website where they're going to review it. And then once they start reviewing it, that's where the real money starts. So to explain that workflow, most lawyers are not comfortable speaking in those terms again in a process type environment. And the time built into it is also really important, because all this happens really fast. It happens at the beginning of the case. A lot of people say, let's just wait and see if it settles before we start doing electronic discovery. And then, bam, you know, you're up against some kind of a deadline that's physically impossible to meet, to process all that data and deal with all the exceptions and all the problems in the data, and then get it up on a website and reviewed by humans or machines or however they choose to do it. You just simply run out of time and everybody's stressed out. So I think that project management is a piece that lawyers, again, the legal education process could really focus on and do a better job of training students.
Anne raises a good point here. It's not always the lawyer's fault, too, that the attorney messes. There's a client here somewhere that sometimes doesn't want to spend the money right away, hopes it will go away. And, you know, time, money, resources, the consulting triangle. If you take away time, it's going to cost more resources and money. It's not that complicated, so, and then you throw in the mix, maybe there's a lawyer on the other side that doesn't understand it so well, and then you're really off the races. So It is a pretty messy area. A lot of things can cause those sort of problems.
Well, just to give you a real-world example, that actually just happened to me. We were talking to the client. We said, look, we can spend X number of dollars to get this data in.
Thomas is going on the internet.
Just right. dealt with. And the client said no. And at the end of the day, everybody has to realize when you're talking about that a gig's worth of data is, what, 5,000 to 10,000 documents, something like that. And every one of those documents ends up having to be reviewed by an attorney at some point in time. So you're looking at the value, at the cost of processing a gig's worth of data versus the hourly cost of an attorney, which may be the same. And so the less documents you can send to attorney review, quite honestly, the better. And my view on that is what it lets us do is it lets us as lawyers focus on what we like to do, which is litigate. All right? Not look at lots and lots and lots and lots of documents. We can litigate by cutting down the amount of documentation that has to go to lawyers.
All right, well, let's stick with this. Talking about vendors and the processing of this information, I've heard a lot about artificial intelligence in the realm of e-discovery.
Okay.
Well, what can you guys tell us about it? You know, can you describe how it works, its popularity, and how lawyers are involved in the process when these programs are used?
Why don't I first start out by sort of defining predictive coding and demystifying a little bit. How many people here use email? Raise your hand. Okay. You're all using predictive coding, okay? Predictive coding is basically taking sets of documents and moving them into categories, okay? And the reason you move them into categories is you have an understanding of the types of documents you want in this category versus this category. Now let's look at the world of spam. We know, you know, drugs, work at home, sex, all different types of things that come in and hit email boxes typically look like spam. So these tools are trained to do this, you know, pretty much out of the box. And you can train your spam filter by going in and saying, no, you made a mistake. What lawyers do today, typically, is they meet and they agree on words that they think are in the documents. Now, there are a couple problems with that, okay? It's called the game of Go Fish, if you've played it, okay? Ralph Losey's immortalized this.
We're talking about simple keyword searches.
Simple keyword searches, okay? You now have to have matches between the words that you've said, you've guessed, and put on the list that you want, search against the documents. That is really hard to do because words have so many different meanings, and people have their own internal dictionaries, so they use different meanings to describe the same thing. It's far better to actually take a sampling of documents. I believe, you know, I blogged about it, I've done a lot of shows, take a sampling of documents over the population that you're going to produce and code it, the ones, the documents you want. If you find documents that you want, you've now got arrays of words. Words have friends and they have synonyms. And you can measure at the beginning using sampling how many documents are possibly in a population that are relevant. And there are math ways to get comfortable that you've hit an end result that's comfortable, you know, for both sides. So there's a way to cooperate and talk to both sides to share your results. And these are the types of battles that are now being fought in cases in New York and in Chicago, the Silva Moore case and the Clean case in Chicago. And the lawyers are having a really hard time, and their experts are having a hard time coming up with ways that work. So we've got a lot of work to do in this area, and these, again, this is opportunity for future lawyers to try to help figure it out. But, you know, there's a real battle, and a lot of people still really like using the keywords because you know what you're getting. It's comfortable. This is what, I don't know what's in the black box that you've just trained. And getting people comfortable with sampling and showing them how you trained it, you know, these are battles that are being fought right now in the legal community. And they are really battles. There's some serious dividing lines in this, and there's a lot of money at stake too, because, you know, time is money, and if people are reviewing, there's more money being made doing review. And that's one of the big issues here. If you have a machine and you're using sampling, you know, it's quicker, faster, you know, where did that money just go? You know, that there's a real issue here. So you know, you're graduating an interesting time coming out, and you're going to be watching this debate occur. And I think there are opportunities for lawyers that understand this to have an interesting verdict.
Pam?
I have seen there are decisions that say you can use keyword searching and predictive coding, or a combination of both, a linear review, looking at one document at a time, running machine code through it. I think we're going to have to use predictive coding because of the volume of documents. When you're looking for privileged documents, it's been used to filter out attorney-client privilege, work privilege, and it really depends on the program you use. Some use a thesaurus, and you have to build that database to catch the terms that may be privileged. Others use mathematics, which I'm personally a fan of, because then you can rely on it. But whatever software you use, it has to be reliable, it has to be defensible, you have to understand the process so that you can explain it to the court as to why the privileged documents, you were reasonable in your search for documents that were relevant and privileged. I think it's very interesting, though, the diverse offerings in the market, and I have used one predictive coding product that was excellent. You know, you could train it, you could do what we do, seeded predictive coding, meaning you feed in example documents and it learns from those documents mathematical relationship between words and it will hit those words every time, versus a thesaurus where you have to build words that are alike, like you have to say igloo, but that also can mean Eskimo or Alaska. So I've used one that was excellent. We did the QC on it, we caught all the documents. I used another that missed about 50% of the privileged terms. If you turn that over to the other side, you could never have a defensible privilege search that would survive a motion in court to say that it was unreasonable that you turned over privileged documents.
So
that's right. So it really depends on what software package you use. You have to be comfortable with the software. And I am also a big fan of quality assurance and quality control methods, again, the process, because lawyers aren't used to doing that. I was involved in a case where a lawyer just took a CD from a vendor, turned it over to the other side, and all the documents that were hot documents, bad for their side, were still marked as hot documents. So they basically gave the other side a roadmap to their work product, their whole case strategy. So,
actually, Ann gave a good example of the e-discovery issues that lawyers have problems with, the 502D. Okay, and we just had this in the Friends of e-discovery meeting, which is a networking group we have here in Pittsburgh. For years, Judge Brin has been trying to get people to recognize there's too much evidence. We run the risk of turning over privileged documents every time we deal with these types of large productions. So let's give people a get out of jail card. If people will go to the court, both parties, and agree that they are not going to waive privilege, they can craft an order that the judge will sign saying privilege wasn't waived, hand the documents back, there has to be a remedy associated with it. At the recent Friends of e-Discovery meeting, a recent judge on the bench, Judge Hornack, said he's now gotten
65
502D motions, which I thought Judge Grimm will be celebrating because we've done podcasts saying why aren't people using these? He then said of the 65, there were zero attached orders. Okay? The order is the mechanism that is your remedy that you suggest. The judge then has to come up with a remedy, which is exactly what 502D and E were supposed to protect. This is an example, again, of how complicated e-discovery is. A lot of people have heard about 502D, and now they're asking for it, but they're not getting deeper into the issue and trying to understand it. That's an easy example. Now, in our debate about technology, you can imagine how crazy things are, but that's a lot harder to explain.
But the software has gotten much better over the last 5-10 years. I mean, tremendously better.
And it's going to continue to get better, and it's going to be front and center. So speaking in that vein, one of Carl's good friends, Maura Grossman, is quoted in the April 2012 ABA Journal on the business of law, and she and a co-author put together an article called Technology-Assisted Review and E-Discovery Can Be More Effective and More Efficient Than Exhaustive Manual Review. It appeared in the Richmond Journal of Law and Technology in 2011. Now, if I were an in-house attorney and I was looking at my legal budget and I read the following, on average, technology reduced the number of documents that a human had to examine by more than 98%. A 50-fold savings. Don't you think that in-house attorney will be recommending to the CFO and the CIO and the CEO that we're going to use machines rather than individuals to review all of these documents. So this is the coming wave, I think, and I think, as has been mentioned, the technology is going to get better and better. The machines are going to get better and better. And frankly, as Carl said, this is going to be a problem, if you will, for the legal profession because, and I have two children who are lawyers. One's an 8-year associate, one's a 2nd-year associate. And many law firms use young associates and paralegals initially to do document review. Well, let's say that all of that document review is done by a machine. So what happens to the young associates? What happens to that profit center within the law firm? And so there is going to be, I think, a seismic shift, you know, in the legal profession as we go forward. And those people that are, quote, going to win are those people that are going to know how to use technology to their best advantage, to their client's best advantage. In addition to this article, and I know Carl attended the tech show, I found it interesting that the ABA Journal also mentioned that looking forward, at least one prognosticator thinks that there could be as many as 10 to 40% fewer lawyers in the next decade than there are today. Now, admittedly, my generation is finally going to retire because I think they will have overcome the loss of monies that they went through in 2007, 2008. In addition, I think you're going to see some of the traditional legal work that had been done by young associates is not going to be there for young associates.
I know some people are about to lose their pizza in the audience. I want to throw some silver lining out here, okay? Because if you look at the role technology plays, well, first of all, I wrote an article on Forbes called Legal Hydra, and it talks about all examples I could think of where lawyers have tried to create, you know, approaches with technology without using technologists to help them, and they've, I think, been less than successful. If you understand and look and embrace technology, there's a real shortage of this out there in the community. You can see it in the cases that are happening right now. Even the experts, there's a shortage of experts that can explain this. There's a great blog on the Da Silva case. The plaintiff's expert, they had agreed to use predictive coding, objected, and said there was a conspiracy between the judge and the industry, and these are all the themes running in their brief. They were railroaded into this decision. They want to validate it. And, you know, a well-respected computer scientist, Herb Rootblatt, said, you're getting the null set, which are the documents coded to train, where they said not responsive, so you can make changes. You're getting every single sample handed over, and you can object at any time. In essence, you're the judge. I don't know what you're objecting to. You have more opportunity to influence the process than perhaps any plaintiff has ever had. And and they miscited the track data. That was basically their brief. There was nothing in there that was very useful. And that's an expert in the leading case in New York right now. That should spell opportunity, that people just are having a hard time figuring this out. Even though we all buy things online and these mysterious ads pop up that are close to things we've been looking for. Even though medical researchers are studying results of tests and coming up with new ways to do medicine, for some reason the legal community, we really have a hard time changing. And there's a real shortage of these people out here, so don't be scared. Study technology if you're interested, or do areas of law that don't involve technology as much. I mean, enjoy being a lawyer. Doctor Who is not that exciting.
No.
I sell Doctor Who. Okay, I'm anti-review almost as a person that sells review. I'm more about intelligent review, and that's basically using technology.
But Carl's point is well taken, and although these predictions are out there, when you look at these four panelists that are sitting with me, I mean, they are some of the few in the Allegheny County catchment of lawyers. There are 7,500 or 8,000 lawyers in Allegheny County Bar Association. And when we as judges looked at those people that applied to be special masters for our e-discovery cases, and by the way, you get paid by the hour or the day to do this work, this is not pro bono work, there were very few that had the credentials. So there's a great opportunity there if you, number one, understand the legal underpinnings, number two, you know something about mediation, and certainly you know a lot about technology and you keep your skills sharp. And as these new kinds of equipment, searching, coding, all comes into play, you are in the forefront. Even in my own daughter's instance, for example, and she's with a multi-state, very large commercial litigation firm, she took the time to really learn the area. So as a senior associate in her firm, she's the go-to person for e-discovery issues. So there is an opportunity there, but you have to embrace, if you will, these issues.
I think one of the other points that really kind of echoes what Judge Fisher said is I think, and I hate to use this term, but I think there's going to be a paradigm shift back. What happened was years and years ago, when this started to explode, they would take all this data and, frankly, offshore a lot of it, send it over where it was cheaper, you could get really decent prices to have people review it like crazy. Now, the prices there are coming up, and we're finding ways to pull the data back so that we don't have as much data. I think what you're going to see over time is it's going to shift back. We're not going to be offshoring data. We're going to actually be spending our time with lawyers here in firms looking more carefully at less documents. So there is going to be a market for the lawyer who's going to want to deal with this. And as Carl said, knowing how to use the tools, knowing how to make this work is one of the best ways to be able to make yourself valuable in that area. So I think we're ultimately going to move to a point. My theory is we're going to get back to a point, like I said, where we're going to be lawyers, where we can litigate again, instead of spending all of our time looking at documents. So the focus is going to change.
Yeah. Where do you learn? You know, I'm going to throw out a plug that, that you mentioned earlier. ESI Bytes, my labor of love. It's ESI Bytes with a Y, and .com. We've done about 170 free podcasts. Had the leading judges in the country on the show, on various shows. They're broken by topic. I have gotten emails and calls from people in firms. One of my favorite was a guy who was a runner at a firm, big firm by the way. He got hired for benefits at the firm internally, and then they asked him to start learning about e-discovery. So he's been listening to the podcast and learning a lot because it's free. And he thanked me. He said he's created a position within a large firm. It's a little scary. But it's also there. You know, there's a shortage. It shows a shortage of resources that are out there. Secondly, for the people that are interested here, I'm willing to stay afterwards and show you my slide deck on predictive coding. It's really hard to explain. And it's easier with a PowerPoint. And third, I think you've done a great job here, Steve, pulling this together. Yeah. I'm an entrepreneur. The field's got so busy, I'm willing to let you help me with ESI Bytes. You can do a couple shows, you know, and that's a good way to work. I'll pay you what I pay myself. But the reality is it's a good learning opportunity, and I've been impressed with what you pulled together here. And, you know, if you're interested, there's an offer here for an internship.
So. I also wrote an article on predictive coding. It came out in November. It was in the Bureau of National Affairs. I wrote it with Bob Eisenberg, who started the Georgetown e-Discovery Center. And the Georgetown e-Discovery Center puts out lots of articles, very practical information on not only what is e-discovery, what is predictive coding, but how do you come up with a budget for e-discovery, depending on how big your case is, what vendor you're using. Very useful information. My class at Duquesne, everyone who interviews my students tell me that they now, when my students come in, they say to them, what's the mantra? Because I've taught them, reduce the data set, reduce the data. So they all go in and say, custodian, relevant date, and file type. So it's real funny because people come back to me and said, that student knew the mantra. So just simple, basic, you know, understanding the field is really important. And I don't think law schools do a very good job at it. They are starting to have software incorporated into a lot of law school programs throughout the country. I'm linked into about 50 law professors, and I think about 15 of them now are using someone's software. People always give you software for free. If you tell them you're a student and you want to learn about their software, you call Clearwell, Access Data, anyone. They will get on, they will give you a demo, and it will be a good first start to some real practical experience. And you can say, I know how to tag and code and categorize. It will help you tremendously in an interview.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity here, because if you as an associate can go in to a law firm or whoever that you're doing legal work for and say, you know, I can handle that. I've done this before. I can take it off your desk and do the initial run with it. They're going to love you. They just will.
And as Carl said, there's a lot of free information out there on the internet. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Sedona Conference. And, you know, if you go to its website, you're going to see a lot of the latest teaching, you know, in this area as it relates to electronic discovery, cooperation among counsel and the like. Certainly the Georgetown Institute that Anne has mentioned. And to that end, Judge Conte, for example, was a featured speaker. I'd also put in a plug for our local Federal Bar Association. In conjunction with our court, every quarter over lunch, they do updates on electronic discovery. We have one coming up on May 10 on electronic discovery in relation to patent litigation. And then in addition to that, the Pennsylvania Bar Institute has some good written materials on electronic discovery. There's a seminar coming up in April, and among the writers is a fellow named David Reese or Rice, who's from Thorpe Reed, and his writings are always well done. I know specifically in that particular instance, he's going to be speaking about the ethics issues that relate to counsel, because as Anne alluded to, ultimately it's counsel, you know, who is at the front line. And, you know, you as counsel, as well as your client, can be sanctioned by the court. And those sanctions can take all kinds of parameters. It could be monetary, it could be dismissal of your case, and anything in between. So there's a lot of information out there and a lot of information that's generally free. And my suggestion to all of you, in addition to the classes that you might be taking here, I hope you're all taking evidence, you need evidence, but beyond evidence, if you keep yourself up to date with what's there on the internet, even our own court website, look at our 26F report, look at our ADR policies, practices, and procedures, look at our special master program, look at the people who are listed there, you know, as our special masters. That will give you, I think, a lot of insights that you can carry into practice. And don't be afraid to either speak on podcasts or write. I mean, for example, that Race Tower tire case is out there. Anybody could write a law note on it right now. It's cutting edge.
There's a site, a failure, you know, it's okay to fail, okay? I tried to create a site called Law Blog Review for law students, and Judge Grimm and Judge Shenlin, and I got a bunch of very powerful judges behind it, and we got a couple students, one from Duquesne, helped Alex, and it went nowhere. Not a single posting by anyone, you know? I mean, you know, so there's a shell of a site that's up there, and, you know, I've always said if you're trying to get a job and get noticed, you should get noticed. You know, being a lemming and just going in state lockstep doesn't always work out. You know, I was on law review and had an MBA from Carnegie Mellon and almost unemployed coming out because I came out of a bad market. And, you know, so then you gotta figure out how to be different and provide skills that the marketplace needs.
So. Good. I don't want to keep you guys too much longer, but any closing thoughts for all the law students here, whether it's related to the e-discovery or just any advice in general?
I think it's such a big area with so much room. I mean, there's information governance, which is part of e-discovery. There's the techie stuff from software to, you know, deploying a platform in a corporation or a law firm. There's just knowing how to be a good lawyer and write really good motions about the defensibility of predictive coding or your process. I just think there's so much room that you can be an expert in one small area, and it can be a real career for you. I like it. It's only, you know, 8-9 rules, and I can handle that, so I'm okay.
It's really growing, too, so this is an opportunity for everybody.
I guess I would say one trying to learn it. Like, there are a lot of sites out here, but also one of Carl's big pet peeves. Try to work with your technologists to get to understand what it is you're working on, because you need to be able to cooperate and work with them so that you can actually do all of this e-discovery stuff. And then I'm going to leave you with one other thing, which is kind of my theory on law of practice to begin with, and that is we kind of have to be able, as a group in Pittsburgh, and we see this a lot in Pittsburgh especially, to get along and cooperate in this process. E-discovery is one of the most critical areas where you need to learn to cooperate and work these problems out, because I can tell you there will be problems almost every day that will come up that you have to deal with the other side, and cooperation is one of the best ways to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, I think my passing thought on it is it's an opportunity. There's definitely a shortage of people that are out there. But I wouldn't chase it unless you want to be passionate about technology and law. Just chasing a job is sometimes the wrong strategy. It should tie in your passions. I know that's hard to do when you're trying to find a job. And many lawyers end up in jobs without any knowledge. I ended up at a firm that told me to do this. I think that's the most common reason why people end up doing what they're doing. But you know, you're at a point where you can sort of frame what you're interested in. And if you have a passion for this area and you step into a firm already able to show you have a passion in this area, you might have a little bit more control because there's a shortage of these types of people. But I wouldn't chase anything unless you really, really wanted to do it. I mean, you know, because then that, no one get on the couch, we're not going to psychoanalyze. Yeah, it's not a good thing in 20 years. Anyway.
I think I've already passed on some advice, but one thing that Ann stated, and I tell my current interns or law clerks this all the time, in approaching your job search, you have to think outside the box, because as you know, this is not a great job market. But having said that, this particular skill and what you learn about electronic documents, not only management but retrieval, ties into corporate governance, it ties into compliance. It has lots of repercussions beyond the big law firm, you know, beyond litigation, mergers and acquisitions, buying a company where there's some kind of an environmental risk, buying a company where perhaps the employees all have some kind of breathing problems, and securing the data to see why they had these kinds of problems. These skills come up over and over again. So you can use your legal training, you can use the technology training, and you can combine them together and find yourself, you know, a good position, hopefully that you'll be passionate about. But admittedly, you got to pay the bills and you got to pay off those loans. But to that end, I would just suggest to you, think about, you know, the bigger world out there. Physicians are finally getting it, and they're going into this whole electronic world kicking and screaming. Mm-hmm. I would suggest to you, there's a role for lawyers in all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's working for the government, whether it's going to be working for the IRS if Obamacare stays the law of the land and people are looking for those who are engaged in fraud, you know, whether it's in a hospital, whether it's with a medical plan, even in a big, large practice, they're going to have needs for these kinds of assistance.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming again. This has been a very informative lecture from all of you. Okay. And again, this will be available on ESI Bytes, so tell all of your other law student friends that it's available. And talk to the administration about getting another e-discovery class here. We currently only have a seminar taught by Professor Wasserman. I took that last semester. It was fantastic. She is a saint. I recommend it, but I feel that we need a survey class on electronic discovery.
Yeah, I put in a proposal 2 years ago and got down.
And I first met Anne as a professor at DuPage, she was teaching the e-discovery class at Duquesne and got involved with our summer intern program, came in and gave lectures there. And, you know, from that expertise, she's now an attorney at Reed Smith, as well as continuing on as faculty at Duquesne. So, again, it's an opportunity. Can I just make one plug to the young women that are here? Today at 3:00 in the afternoon, the Pennsylvania Bar Institute Commission on Women in the Profession is doing a symposium on making your first impression, whether that is in terms of securing a job or making the order. It's free. It's at the Heinz Center right next to the Duquesne Club. Starts at 3 o'clock, will be over at 5 o'clock. They brought in an excellent speaker for this program. If any of you are interested, like I said, it's totally free. And it starts at 3, runs till 5.
All right. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Shandy's notes. Your name's come up so